Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how warming temperatures in the valley are impacting mosquito breeding.
And why former Tucsonan Nico Case loves listening to the radio.
But first, yesterday was the deadline for the seven Colorado River Basin states to come to an agreement on new rules for the over-allocated river. They did not, but the Interior Department did agree to wait before it imposes its own set of rules, citing progress being made toward a deal between the states. At the same time, Governor Katie Hobbs and bipartisan legislative leaders have sent a letter to Interior Secretary Doug Burgum accusing the upper basin states, Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, and New Mexico, of refusing to implement cuts to their water supplies. With me now to talk more about this and what might come next is Ted Cook, board member of the Water Infrastructure Finance Authority of Arizona and former general manager of the Central Arizona Project. Ted, good morning.
Good morning.
So I'm curious, like, what you make of the fact that the states didn't come to a deal by yesterday, but that the feds seem to be saying we're willing to wait and see if you guys maybe can come to a deal before the federal government comes in and sets the rules.
Well, yesterday's news was disappointing for sure, but really I think it's pretty much what everyone expected to happen. And this will give some more time for the states to continue to work together. Unfortunately, it's pretty common over the last couple of decades for the United States to do that. Everyone believes that a seven-state deal is better than any other outcome because basically everybody agrees going into it during the environmental impact statement evaluation process, rather than having the United States come in and impose something that increases the likelihood of lawsuits. But despite that belief that the seven state deal is better, no such deal has come forth. And my belief from having been involved in those type of conversations before is the references to progress are encouraging things that are maybe satellite issues that don't constitute a deal on their own, but might be things that would be included if they could get to agreement on the key issues that have basically been in deadlock for a year and a half.
Hmm. I mean, do you share the federal government's seeming optimism that a deal can be reached?
Well, I think that's a matter of time, number one, and we're running out of it, if not having run out of it, number one. And number two, there's also a tendency, I think, as time wears on, at least based on my past experience, that the bar is lowered as time goes on, and the willingness to accept compromises that really are not in the best interest of the river and declare victory when it's really not, it then becomes a problem.
It's interesting because, as you say, the bar gets kind of lowered, but at the same time, it doesn't seem as though the rhetoric is necessarily being lowered. I mean, I mentioned Governor Hobbs's letter to the Interior Secretary, where she basically blamed all the problems on the upper basin states. And we've heard upper basin states kind of blaming, you know, Arizona, California, and Nevada for all the river's problems. So, like, I wonder if that is just sort of the rhetoric of it, or if that is in and of itself somewhat of an impediment to reaching a deal.
Well, all of the rhetoric does, from both sides, does include at least a kernel, I'll call it, of maybe legitimacy, where there's a legitimate beef or a legitimate point of view that may be at odds with each other, and those issues need to be worked out in order for the states to come to a deal. The increase in the rhetorical vehemence over the last couple of months is probably not really helpful. It has a side benefit, though, I think, of illustrating some of the difficulty that there is and the complications, the complex nature of some of these issues that need to be resolved. And there's really two of them, if I may, of these two issues that have been at an impasse for a year and a half. One of them is basically who among the states and how much each state is going to take in reductions that are necessary to stabilize the river and its reliability. And the other one is how Lake Powell is operated to release water from the upper basin to the lower basin and in what quantities each year and based on which rules. And those are the two main things, and they're not coming to any kind of conclusive end on those type of things and just going around in circles.
Well, and you reference the timing of this, and obviously the longer it takes to come to a deal or have the feds impose a deal, the longer the current rules are in place. And as you've alluded to, the river needs help at this point. So I wonder, like, what the fact that we're delaying for some more amount of time, like, what does that do to the supply of water that the states will ultimately be divvying up?
Well, the current set of rules, it's the 2007 guidelines that were from 2007 and were to last for 20 years, don't expire until September 30th of 2026. So those rules are in place. Everybody knows what to expect for the next 9 or 10 months. But if that period of time expires and there's no deal, then we don't go back to the 2007 rules. We go back to the long-term operating criteria that were formulated in the 1970s, which is a pretty scary scenario right there. So as we're running out of time, if the states don't complete a deal, and they have not been successful in doing that, despite the claims of progress, and then so the next thing would be, well, does the United States impose a plan of its own and risk litigation and things like that? What if that doesn't happen? What if it gets put off indefinitely? And to your question, then, well, what happens then? The United States will not, despite their reluctance to actually take charge and put a plan of their own in place, they will not let the infrastructure fail. But a last minute, we're going to do this tomorrow because we have to type of action is even less preferable than them stepping in earlier. So the real question is, well, at what point in time between now and September 30th of next year, does the United States really, really, really need to step in and do something on their own if the states continue to be at an impasse? And there is a process, the NEPA process, National Environmental Policy Act, that has to happen that will take several months to do. So lots of folks are referring to yesterday's deadline. There was a second deadline, yesterday's deadline being have the outline, let's call it, of a deal among the states available, and then that would be finalized between now and mid-February or thereabouts. So,
got it.
So there's another deadline, and I think that's one of the excuses why, well, we really do have more time, so why don't we just use it? Well, what will happen if we get to that point? And I'm not optimistic that 3 more months is going to make a difference after a year and a half of basically going around in circles.
Interesting. All right, we'll have to leave it there. Ted Cook, former general manager of the Central Arizona Project, board member of the Water Infrastructure Finance Authority of Arizona. Ted, thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
The State Health Department says there have been more than 60 cases of West Nile virus so far this year. There were 82 cases in 2023 and 60 the year before that. And new research from ASU finds there are more mosquitoes here now than in the past, although climate change may have an impact on their population. Kelsey Leiberger is an assistant professor in ASU's College of Integrative Sciences and Arts, where she studies the ecology of mosquitoes. And when she came by the studio to talk about her new work, she told me when she started at ASU recently, she was surprised by how much of a threat West Nile is in the desert.
Thinking about the distribution of some of these vectors and mosquitoes in general, they like it warm and they like it wet. But Phoenix is so hot in the summer, I was surprised they could persist through that heat.
Well, so how are they doing it? Because as you say, Phoenix is pretty darn hot, especially in the summer.
Yeah, and the interesting part about how they're doing that is that I think it depends on what species you're talking about. We have multiple species here in the area, and for some of them, they are finding these little microhabitats, often that we are creating, where it's a little bit cooler and it's wetter, whether that's from irrigation or as we just got some rainfall.
So could this be the kind of thing where, like, in somebody's backyard, you have, you know, maybe a flower pot that's empty that has some water and it's maybe in the shade, so it's out of direct sun? Is that the kind of microhabitat you're talking about?
Yeah, so that would be a perfect habitat for example, a species called Aedes aegypti. They love those human-made containers. But we also have species like Culex, which are the main vectors of West Nile virus. And they're breeding in slightly more organically rich water. And so they're finding storm drains that maybe have backed up a little bit. Or, for example, in this study that I've been working on over the summer, we went to a bunch of nurseries where they're overwatering or they're healthily watering some trees. And another big one here that I'm not sure I would have thought of beforehand is empty swimming pools. So people maybe take off for the hot summers and leave their pools, maybe drain them, but then they fill again if we get rainfall, and they love breeding in there. And you can imagine a swimming pool full of mosquitoes certainly breeds a lot.
Yeah, that's a lot of space. I mean, that could probably lead to a lot of mosquitoes and potentially a lot of illness.
Yeah, and the swimming pool mosquitoes are one of those vectors for West Nile virus. And so the vector control, the county vector control guys around here are doing their best, and they have a huge investment in setting traps and monitoring the situation, both in terms of mosquito abundance, but also that they test them, the mosquitoes themselves, to see if they're carrying the virus. And if kind of any thresholds are hit, they're going to go out and do something about it.
How big of a temperature difference do you find that the mosquitoes need from sort of, you know, maybe the high temperature at Sky Harbor to where it is a better place for them to breed? Like, are we talking just a couple of degrees, or does it have to be more than that to make it ideal conditions for them?
Yeah, so a place like Sky Harbor can record temperatures of like 120, whereas kind of the limits for these mosquitoes, they can't survive beyond something like 110.
Okay.
And so we're finding these mosquitoes are in places easily 10 to 15 degrees cooler than a weather station might report.
But even 110 degrees, I mean, during, you know, let's say July or August, a good part of the valley, if not all of it, is routinely above 110. And yet, as you're finding, these mosquitoes are still breeding.
Yeah. So that really touches on a couple of things that I want to do with my research, which is that right now a lot of the kind of science of the temperature limits of mosquitoes is considered in terms of a single number. Like, what is their thermal maximum? What's that one hot temperature? But really, survival at those temperatures is a function of time. So we might hit 110 for a few hours, but then at night, you're going to have reprieve from that. It's going to drop down. And so really, you touch on what I'm hoping to do in the lab next, which is test for how long can they withstand these really hot temperatures.
I mean, do you think it's possible, and not that anybody is hoping for Phoenix to get hotter, but if it does, could we kind of heat our way out of a disease like West Nile virus?
That would be awesome if it happened, but I'm guessing not. I'm guessing for the most part it's here to stay because these mosquitoes are great at finding the habitats that we create for them to mitigate that heat. And it doesn't take much for them to successfully breed, emerge as these adults and females looking for a blood meal. And to add on to that, which is that West Nile virus itself has to replicate inside the mosquito and that process is temperature sensitive. So as you heat the outside air, the virus can replicate more quickly inside the mosquito. And that means transmission could happen even faster.
I wonder if that also means transmission could potentially happen later in the season here than it would maybe somewhere on the East Coast when it starts to cool off a little bit. And yet, you know, we're still getting a little bit of rain. You know, there might be some sort of latent moisture around.
Yeah, definitely. I could see warming leading to a longer West Nile virus season. And in fact, even on the East Coast, a recent study came out saying that's exactly what they're seeing is a longer season with warmer temperatures.
How ideally would you like this research to be used, either by vector control folks or anybody else?
Yeah, part of the goal of this is to better understand the thermal limits of these mosquitoes. To answer questions about, are there going to be changes in seasonality in the abundance of the mosquitoes or year-to-year variation? And so how vector control can use that and make different decisions about how they operate, I leave that to them, and I try to provide them the scientific basis on which they can make those decisions. Same thing for public health. Agencies, they might be interested in knowing whether that potential season for West Nile virus is going to increase.
All right. That is Kelsey Leiberger, an assistant professor in ASU's College of Integrative Sciences and Arts. Kelsey, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, in her first memoir, singer-songwriter Nico Case shares intimate details about one of her least favorite writing subjects, herself.
I didn't have anybody to teach me how to be or what to do with emotions. Didn't know how to contain them or how to express them or how to soothe them.
We'll hear from the Grammy-nominated artist.
But first, back in May, I spoke to the artist-in-residence at ASU Gamage, Christopher Rivas. Rivas is a theater artist, an author, and a podcaster. And in that first conversation, he previewed a theater piece he's been developing called How to Get Free. He was in the early stages of the project then, and we talked about how it was inspired by Rivas's experience in relationships, his life as a person of color in America, and the Greek myths of Sisyphus, Tantalus, and Narcissus. Now the project is ready to debut. He'll bring How to Get Free to the stage at ASU Gamage this Saturday. I caught up with Chris for a follow-up conversation on how the piece has evolved over the last few months, and we began by talking about how he has woven those Greek myths into the story that he's telling in the show.
We use these lessons to not punish ourselves anymore, you know, to set ourselves free. I think these are lessons that are still very present, and I think we all embody them in different ways. And I make the case in the show that you are embodying them right now. You are pushing a boulder up a hill. You don't need to push up a hill anymore. You are tantalized by something so much so that it changes you, and it maybe steals some of your peace and your presence and your joy. You are narcissistic in a way that it can cause suffering, and so am I.
You know, I'm really glad you mentioned this idea that part of that revelation that you're going for is the "and so am I" part of it, because I had the opportunity to see a workshop production of the show this summer, and we had talked in our last conversation about your interest and willingness to use your own experience as part of the storytelling. But even in spite of the fact that you had shared that in our last conversation, I was really struck by just how personal the writing in this was. The language that you're using in a lot of the early part of the show felt like it was almost a transcript of a real therapy session that you might have had. You were speaking about very specific details of a relationship that I imagined must have had something in common with real experiences that you had. And there's also, I should say, photos of you as a little kid in the show, and
As a big kid.
As a big kid. Yeah, you're really mining yourself here.
You know, the way I make work is that's my cross to bear. Like, I don't know how to make work another way without my own experience. We could look at our own life and we could see the world. And so that's how I know to make art. It's how I've always made art. So I don't feel vulnerable. I don't feel not vulnerable. It's just something I've become really, it's my practice. It is my practice to get closer to myself, to unveil myself, to share myself with others. You know, I have a therapist who says, I'm not trying to like be like, oh, I'm so good at this. Look at me, how vulnerable I am. That is performative vulnerability. You wrote it, and so you're prepared to share it. A real vulnerability is when you're not prepared, when there's no script. And so I'm still doing that work as well.
You're saying like being vulnerable in your therapeutic treatment.
In your life,
yeah.
Real vulnerability is there's no script. There's no play I wrote that I've been developing for over 2 years. There's just the moment. And then you have to decide, are you going to close off? Or are you going to open up? And so, you know, when I perform these pieces, you know, it's like I was willing to share that. I did the work to share that.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I see what you're saying. But that is very interesting in the context of this show, because the level at which you are kind of mining these personal experiences, I hear you saying that it is cultivated, it is within the language of performance. The audience can rest assured that you are safe in doing this. You're not putting yourself in psychological danger before their very eyes.
Yes, I'm not. I do like to say, as artists, this is what I encourage. We share scars, not wounds. And so I have done the work to look at the wounds, and they are now scars. And I think scars are beautiful. And that is across all my work. And it is a tenet, I really believe, for all artists. We share scars, not wounds.
But then it is interesting to me that all of those things acknowledged, you are doing a lot of things in the actual presentation of the show, it seems to me, to invite the audience to consider where those boundaries really are. For example, one of the things that you did, again, at least in the workshop version that I saw, is you literally turned a camera on yourself, not just in terms of the way the writing worked, but you actually were holding a camera that you were pointing at yourself. And then we see that projected on the walls. Another fascinating element of the production, in my opinion, was that for the first portion of the show, at least, you were literally contained within a box. It was almost like you were trapped within yourself. And then at a certain point, you get free, as it were, of the box.
Yeah, I like what you talk about with the edge. That is something I do love. You know, I'll keep in this scar wound metaphor.
Uh-huh.
The exciting part to me of healing and growth is the rim of the wound, as you watch the wound heal. It's not so far detached that it's like, I don't even think about it. It's not fresh that it hurts to poke. And it feels like actively happening. That's why theater, that's why art. Otherwise it's boring. It has to feel active. Like I'm experiencing this in the moment. And then there's the Buddhist element in me, which really just believes all we're ever doing is interacting with ourselves. It's just different versions of you, and you really just want to understand and know you. And if we all kind of understood and accepted that truth, our eyes might open a little. We wouldn't be trapped in that box of me, me, me.
Well, that is an implicit argument, I feel like, that you and other artists are making by putting yourself into the work, is in a way you are saying, aren't I just you in a different body with a different set of specific embodied experiences? But if I can put my true experience out there and you can relate to it, on some level, you and I must be each other.
Yes. You know, if the piece is called How to Get Free, one of the best ways we can get free is to think of this me, this literal me-ness in us, less in our lives. Like if I can think of me less, I have more room to think of others and to actually see others and see what's here and what's happening. I do make the argument that for a couple of times a day, if we can plant ourselves off center, there is a tremendous peace and freedom that can take place.
Well, that is, again, something that you actively do in this production, because for all that I have been talking so far about the very personal camera at the self, literally and figuratively, elements of this show, there are also a number of moments where you actually invite the audience onto the stage and you address them directly and you invite the audience to interact with each other. You invite the audience to literally change the stage.
We call the piece, you know, it goes from analog to digital, or it goes from small to large. There is really an evolution of how you experience the piece even, right? And that to me is, I want to embody also the evolution. I want to embody, like we just said, the wound to the scar. I want to embody the realization to the living out the realization.
Well, Chris Rivas is a theater artist, currently the artist in residence at ASU Gamage, and his show, How to Get Free, is this Saturday, November 15th at 7 p.m. at ASU Gamage. Chris, thank you for this conversation.
Thanks, Jim.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Let's meet the next maker in our series, Made in Arizona.
I could take risk with embroidery in a way that I couldn't take risks in other areas of art.
A lot of my paintings, gravity doesn't matter a whole lot.
Dance wasn't something that is necessarily seen in galleries, you know? And I just remember being like, this is the key. This is how dance gets out there.
I try to tug at people's heartstrings. I try to do something disturbing.
I escaped real life and I went back in time.
Kanaim Alshati is a visual artist whose work is far from what you might see hanging on the wall in a gallery. In fact, it's often not even the kind of work that is meant to be the center of attention. Concert visuals.
These graphics are in constant motion behind performers at live concerts, moving with the music, bringing the audience into an immersive experience. And Alshati has done graphic art for some big concerts, from Drake to Alicia Keys to Bad Bunny.
He also makes music videos for artists like Kid Cudi, collaborates with visual artists, and makes large-scale public art installations and more. But it wasn't what he set out to do as a community college student years ago. In fact, he started his career working in construction. But as he told our co-host, Lauren Gilger, he knew it wasn't meant to be.
And it was a great job. And despite the fact that it was a great job, I understood in the back of my head, I'm like, this is not going to work out.
This is not my long-term.
This is not going to work out. Every day I'm stressing out. You know, I'm like, what am I going to, you know, and I eventually I just needed them to fire me, to push me.
So did they fire you?
They fired me, yeah. But, you know, it was one of those things where it was like, I have to, you know, you keep screwing up. You keep screwing up little thing after little thing after little thing. And finally, the guy was just like, you know, and I worked for years, but it was finally like, you know, and they could tell my heart was not in this thing, you know.
Yeah.
It gave him the push he needed to get out of construction and go back to school. He studied graphic design and started focusing on motion work.
I'm making videos, right? I'm posting this stuff on YouTube. No one cares. I'm also like just starting to make GIFs, and I'm starting to make really short form, almost like motion paintings. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like something that can just exist, and it's like there's no start and there's no stop. It just kind of is there. So that's the stuff I started posting on Tumblr. That's the stuff that I start really getting into, really obsessed about, making a whole lot of work.
So you build a little bit of a following. You're kind of building up a career in this realm. When was the moment when you said, I don't need a regular job, I'm going to dive into this?
It was way before that. Yeah, I'm just, you know, I never gave myself much of an out as far as that stuff went. I think, you know, I say this to other people, and I almost have to, like, just understand that this is true for me. If it's in you to do the thing, then you should do the thing. But really, it's just, can you be at it long enough to be one of the last people kind of...
You're in a competition with yourself?
With yourself. You know what I mean? You know, can you have the longevity to do this a year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now, and then figure out a way to make it into something? Cause, you know, for a long time, I just didn't worry about money, really. You know, I just didn't worry. Look, I know that I can make enough to pay like the meager bills that I have, and this is fine.
Wow.
It's fine having no savings. It's fine because I'm on a path for a thing. And, you know, I'm just more than anything, I'm like grateful that I didn't turn out to be just crazy. you know.
So let's talk about the moment you realized you weren't crazy and that this was something you could
this
really
is an
do.
Ongoing thing.
You have become successful, though, on some very basic levels, obvious to everyone levels, even if you feel like you're still kind of striving for that. You've shown at SMOCA. You've done public art for cities in the Valley. And then you've done some massive concerts, big music videos. We're talking artists we've all heard of, Drake, Bad Bunny. What's that felt like?
I don't know. It's surreal. Like those aren't the moments where I go like, oh, I've made it. You know, because those are the moments that are just like, what is this? This is crazy. This is it's so funny to like, you know, it you have like a pop star, let's just say.
Yeah.
And pop star is standing there and they're doing their pop star thing. And there's all these people there. They're just like going wild. And I've been a person in that crowd doing that for people that I love. Right.
Yeah.
But then seeing a person stand right in front of your own work is such a trip because it's just I look at that work and it's, you know, I'm sitting in my space by myself making this thing. You know, slowly animating stuff, like either drive myself crazy or not. And then, you know, it's very much like a fingerprint. So it's just I might as well just have my big face, you know, in the background of this person just kind of going, hey, everybody doing that kind of. So it's super surreal. Mm-hmm. And also like this whole thing is such a new medium, whether it's I understand that people have been making visuals for tours for a very long time. But the scale at which you can do it now and how bright. Just the amount of lumens available to push out onto the audience and the crazy contraptions that we can make on stage and stuff.
It's more vivid.
Super vivid optical illusions. Same thing with the public art stuff. It, like even just take like projection mapping like a building or something. Okay, you could have something where the building's melting, this and that. But it's like the building is a canvas. It's like a very new idea.
Yeah.
Like, where does that edge even lie, you know? How do we go way beyond that? Because this is like early days of film almost. It's thought to be like, oh, this is what this thing is. But people haven't been doing it that long at a high level, you know. It's wide open for people to just be indulging. It's beautiful.
The possibilities are endless.
Yeah, I feel like really lucky to just be right time and right place, you know, for stuff.
Okay, so let's talk about your process a little bit because this is multidimensional, right? Like literally. But also you've got a song, right? Or a concert that you're going to do some visuals for. Mm-hmm. So there's sound. There's motion in the work. There's, I'm sure, actual drawings. How do you start?
So for something that would be like a music video that I would make, really I just start sketching things out in the book, whether it's almost think of them as like thumbnails, right? Like thumbnail sketches. Whether it's random scenes that I want to see that have nothing to do with each other and I think of like interesting ways to connect these things or do they connect or what are the similar things here or what are dissimilar things here. Hmm. But really what I do with all clients, regardless of whether I'm the only one involved or not, I say like, give me some verbiage. Like, let me put myself in a little prison of words that you gave me and then I can figure myself out of that. Because if we both agree that the words are right, then I just got to do the feeling and I know how to do the feeling of whatever it is we're talking about, but we have to talk about
You're creating the feeling.
Creating the feeling, right? So it's like, you know, I don't have like a pre-prescribed idea of like, this is what this thing needs to be. I kind of like need the thing to speak to me.
Sure. Give us an example. You have the book here, right? Like you can sketch something for us or show us something you've sketched. Like where does that begin? When you talk about fitting things together or looking at contrast, what does that mean?
So let's say, this is just off the top of my head, but let's say that I want a scene right here. And let's say that there is some kind of crazy, surreal background and there's like, I don't know, there's like a door or something right here, right? Okay, then I need to like make something like that. Then it's like, what is my next scene right here? Maybe I want to go like through the door and I want to go on to like some kind of like surreal like landscape kind of thing. Hmm. And it's just like constantly making like camera directions to myself of like, okay, here's the camera and I need this thing to like scoop.
So you're drawing them like squares, like you're looking in the scene each time. It's almost like drawing out a film reel.
Exactly. And it's just like super loose little blueprints. And then I can start just implementing those in any number of ways. It's so funny. It's like the tools we have to like make things move, to make a dot, to make a pixel move on a screen. It's like you do that in a million one ways. And at this point, I've kind of like I've taken up a lot of those ways. So more or less, it's like, what do I feel like working in? You know, do I feel like working in After Effects? Like, that's cool. I can set up a scene like that in After Effects. Do I feel like sketching things out and transferring them over into Photoshop? Do I feel like taking them into Blender or Houdini, which is like 3D programs? Like, do I feel like adding some kind of like simulation aspect to this so I don't have to animate water? Do I feel like simulating the entire thing as a bunch of nodes within something like Touch Designer? Huh. So like making things like more interactive, like the sky's the limit in terms of like how you put these things together.
Right.
In my mind, it is very much about just like, I draw this, now I have to make this.
Yeah. Let me ask you lastly about the way that you treat this as a practice almost. It sounds like you do this and have for a very long time done it like every day, right? Like this is something you just do, whether it's for something really big or just for you.
Yeah. Well, it's like, how do you take your job seriously? Mm-hmm. You know, another way to phrase it really is like, if I'm always exercising, it doesn't matter if I have to run like a 3K or whatever, 5K. You know what I mean? Like if I'm always doing the thing, it's not that big of a deal if something big comes up. There's a nice balance to everything being the same weight.
You sound very much like a practical person for an artist.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe that's just like the mask that I try to like wear when I'm like trying to articulate anything to anyone else. But, you know, I for sure, when I'm in it, I think I feel a little crazy. Mm-hmm. I feel a little antenna-like. I feel a little like disassociated. And I think a lot of the time when people are talking to me, I can go off into like work mode.
Yeah.
So when I'm not actively in those things, I try my best. Yeah.
Totally fair. All right. We'll leave it there. That is Kenneh Malshati joining us, visual artist. Thank you so much, Kenneh, for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Lauren.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Nico Case, a former Tucsonan and Grammy nominee, is beloved for her eclectic songwriting style, which fans sometimes refer to as country noir. Case has had a big year. She released a new record called Neon Gray, Midnight Green, and a memoir titled The Harder I Fight, The More I Love You. I spoke to Case recently about the differences between what she's after when she writes a song and how she approached writing the book, which she says she couldn't have finished without the guidance of her editor, Carrie Fry. Making her way through her own memories, Case told me, was a tricky process.
When you're telling your own stories, it's hard not to go, is this really dull? You know, I wouldn't have written a memoir if I had had my druthers. I would have written fiction instead, but that's what Grand Central asked me to write, and I was excited to do it.
Can I ask, when it comes to the things that you found yourself putting into the memoir in collaboration with Carrie, were you surprised at the things that Carrie responded strongly to?
Yeah, I think her reaction to things like me biting the heads off of fleas and stuff, you know, she was grossed out, but she was also fascinated. And so I was like, okay, I don't want to put that in there to just gross people out. Like, I want people to understand the level of parentlessness and squalor I was living in. I kind of based things on her reactions regarding those kinds of things.
The way you just put that makes me think about one of the other things in the book that I really love, where you talk about, I'm going to misquote it slightly, but screaming your feelings into a microphone is a reflection of the fact that you maybe didn't have parenting that told you that wasn't a good idea or something along those lines.
I didn't have anybody to teach me how to be or what to do with emotions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Didn't know how to contain them or how to express them or how to soothe them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the abjection of poverty and lack of parenting that you depict in the book, as you were just alluding to, I mean, the fleas thing you were talking about is a really intense sequence where you're talking about coming home and picking the fleas off the dogs and cats and biting their heads off and then spitting them into the space heater.
Yep.
You also write about having to suck on, I think it's dried pasta because there's so little food in the house.
Yeah, sometimes you're bored, you know?
Sure, bored and hungry.
What's a kid going to do?
Did it feel scarier to write that stuff down and put it into a book than, say, scary artistic moments that have come up musically for you?
That stuff is easier. And, you know, I did years of talk therapy and I'm not afraid to talk about anything. But, you know, writing about myself is not my first choice.
Mm.
It's like my last choice.
Does that feel true in music as well?
Most of the time. I mean, I'm in there. You know, my
my perspective is the only one I have. So, you know, I often wish I could just leap into other people's minds and see things through their eyes. But, you know, being in a song and making a story out of it is what's fun for me, mm-hmm. and what feels like play more than work.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas the book was definitely work.
Well, this whole question of fiction and feeling comfortable in fiction, I have to say it does make me think about, there are so many really shocking stories in your book. One of the biggest ones for me, though, is the story of your mom coming up with this lie that she had passed away and roping in a number of your relatives to play along with that. And you being the only one who didn't know that she was still alive. When in your life did the extremity of that situation start to manifest itself for you? Because I think I've seen you say somewhere that it took you well into adulthood to start to really reckon with that experience.
Yeah, I didn't even think it was a weird thing to happen. I think I was in my 20s when I finally told somebody the story, and they replied with, "That is one of the most bizarre things I've ever heard."
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I thought about it and I went, you know what? That is really bizarre.
Yeah.
And it's super weird. And I'm sure I have a weird relationship with death. I think I might be more accepting of it, more. I'm not afraid of it. I'm not afraid to confront death, especially when I'm talking about other people's deaths. I don't feel afraid to talk or to make jokes. I think for a long time, I just didn't trust that people were dead.
So going back then to that experience we were alluding to earlier of putting your feelings into the microphone and through song, where did music come into the picture for you? When did it start to feel like a way of processing all of this?
I think it was just the joy channel. It was a place I could go that wasn't this place. I don't know how much I've processed through music. I have different relationships with the songs. They don't really feel cathartic.
Well, who were some of those first joyful destinations for you that felt particularly good to go spend time with?
I was really into the radio
mm-hmm.
as a kid. And I think the one that really changed me the most was, there was a station in Portland called KMJK, and it played kind of top 40 stuff, but it also played some punk rock. And there was a lot of women on there, mm-hmm. strangely. And so I was like, okay, I know that I have to forge myself into something that gives me the feeling that music gives me. If something existed in the world couldn't pretend I didn't exist.
Yeah. Well, can I ask you about, on the song Winchester Mansion of Sound, there's this refrain of the lyric, "Only music is forever."
Only music is forever, and you're a Winchester mansion of sound.
Where does that sentiment come from?
It's about radio science, the science of radio waves, where all the radio broadcasts that have ever been made are still echoing out into the universe. Even now, the radio waves carry into the universe, which I think is so comforting and beautiful. It never stops.
I love that idea so much, that those broadcasts that you listened to when you first started listening to the radio, and humbly, I will add, this conversation that we are now having on the radio, they're not as fleeting as I often imagine that they are. They're
traveling through the universe like beautiful ripples on a lake.
Well, Nico Case, it has been such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that'll do it for this Wednesday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for being along. A reminder, you can sign up for the show's weekly newsletter. It is called Radioheads. You can sign up at theshow.kjzz.org. For Sam Dingman and Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow. You can play.
far out of tune and still kick me in the heart. Only hear things secondhand and consider you.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.